Accession number 23447, Rail 5.
Mr. Waller, Rail 5. We're talking about when you joined the 9th Battalion Rifle Brigade at El Adam in Tobruk, just about March, just before the siege of Tobruk started in 1941.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned the 6-pounder, but really we're on the 2-pounder. That's what you were on at that stage.
Yes.
The 6-pounder a year later, yeah. I think. So what basically happened then? Did you get any more experience with the 2-pounder, or was it a very quick training session?
One afternoon. Learning how to load and firing at burnt out Italian tanks. Basically, it wasn't a lot to learn on them, really. I mean, it was how you laid and how you loaded, and that's all it comprised. So, I don't think there was much else with the gun. I mean, your number three sat in the seat and fired the gun with a foot pedal, and the number two loaded, and the number one was watching with his binoculars to select his target.
So what happened next then? You obviously rejoined your unit after that afternoon, and were the guns there then?
Yes, they'd been delivered.
How many were there in the platoon, the anti-tank?
B Company was designated to be trained as an anti-tank company. Before that, B Company was ordinary infantry or carriers, but it was designated that they should have some anti-tank guns, and it was decided that B Company would be that. So you had four platoons. Five platoon consisted of, 28, 30 men, and you had four guns in a platoon. And the system was that B Company was always attached to A Company. A Company was then attached, say, to the 1st Tanks, 5th Tanks, or whatever. And that's how it worked. You never fought as a unit or a company, or very rarely. So each platoon was attached to one of the other companies. Can't remember the others. I know we were always with A Company. 6th platoon were most probably with I Company and so forth.
Now, so what happened next then? You got there about March.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, of course, the German attack was launched on the Gazala line, and we were moving back. I think, don't quote me exactly on casualties, but I think it was something like we lost about 50% of the vehicles, either through getting hit, breakdown, stuck in sand, whatever. We lost about 45% of personnel. So one column was made. Yeah, would you like me to check incident?
No, it's all right. It wasn't Gazala, it was further up that they came back from.
Oh, yeah, from Elagilia. But then, they got back to around about Mekelle and Gazala, as far as I remember. That was just before the siege of Tobruk started. So they managed to form one column, which was used for scouting purposes, and all the personnel without transport were told to go into Tobruk and join the garrison there. But we were only in there for, 3 to 4 weeks.
Now what happened during those three to four weeks?
Not a lot. It wasn't completely cut off by then. It took about a month, I think, before Tobruk was completely cut off. And we were inside. It was not intended that we should be there. It was just that because we had no transport, they said go inside Tobruk and sort of help out with the garrison, see what's happening.
And do you remember anything about that time?
Pardon?
Do you remember much about that time?
Well, not a lot. We weren't. Well, I mean, we just formed part of a defensive line. We were not a complete battalion, we were odds and sods, as it were, and under our own command, and we were only there 3 to 4 weeks, by which time, I think that was the time they called the masseuse stakes. Everybody had gone chasing back. And consequently, we were loaded onto a destroyer and sent back to...
What do you remember about the evacuation by destroyer?
A bit noisy. Stukas kept coming in, and as soon as the ships tried to get, you know, came in or leave in the harbour, you used to get Bomb Alley, you know, the Stukas came over.
What was it like being under a Stuka attack? It's
not very pleasant.
Can you describe it for us?
Well, I mean, you always felt, and like the continent, in the desert, you stood out. It was flat, you stood out, and consequently they would attack one or three trucks or anything like that. So it was very limited, you know. I mean, if you were out in the open, you felt that you were their target. And whereas, as I say, on the continent, it was a different matter altogether.
And what about when you were on the ship?
Well, you just lay there and said your prayers until it got clear. Once it got clear, it was all right. But it was getting clear as to Rook Harbour and the immediate vicinity in the sea.
Did they actually try and bomb your ship? I mean, did they get bombs anywhere near you?
Not too near, fortunately, but it was going on all the time. It was a regular thing. I mean, I can't know, it was 4 or 6 times a day they used to come over and bomb the harbour and the town. So it was a question of... And that's why they used destroyers, because they were fast ships. You know, it was a question of get in, get on quick, get on the decks and out, because it was loaded up. There was no... Some were down below, but most of us were on the decks. You just lay on the deck, a bit like the old Dunkirk business, really.
And what happened next? And the destroyer took you back to...
Down to Alex. And then, well, in the... round the Cairo... Well, Cairo, Mina, around that area. And Benny Youssef camp. So, it was a question of them being reformed and doing more training and getting the reinforcements acclimatised.
How did the reinforcements fit in? You were almost one of them.
Yeah, yes. I mean, the main thing it was that you got your knees brown before they did, so you could take the mickey out of them, you see. But no, it's surprising. Everybody got, you know, once you got used to the heat and didn't take your shirt off and get sunburnt, self-inflicted wound, as they called it, they fitted in quite well.
And what sort of training were you doing?
It was, there again, they were doing the new boys on the carriers, you know, getting them used to driving carriers on soft sand and rocky bits.
Like you'd done.
Yeah. And sort of infantry training, you know, infantry advancing across the desert. It depended which section they were going, which company they were going to, whether they were going to the carrier platoon, infantry platoon, or so. But it was general training.
And how were you settling into the unit? Had you made any special pals by that time?
Not particularly, no. Not at that time. It was a bit later that I formed strong friendship.
And what was the sort of life like at the camp? Well, Benny Youssef on Mina.
Yeah, oh, it was pleasant enough. It was.
What would a typical day be like for you then?
Well, you get hauled out of bed at some early hour in the morning and get your ablutions done, have your breakfast, and then you'd be off on training in the desert nearby. It was a sort of standard practice of, you know, what they used to do with reinforcements. So, it passed pleasantly enough, you know. You had your training, and if you were lucky, you got a break at 11 o'clock to go to Nappy, then break for lunchtime, and worked at about 4 o'clock, and then packed in.
And would you get, what would you do for recreation in the evening? Could you get into Cairo at all?
We didn't, no. No, the the main event was the RSM's bingo session.
Tell me about that then.
Howsy, you know. It was the only type of gambling that was officially allowed in the army, and used to turn up, and you could always get a couple of bottles of Stella beer, and you know, and games of Howsy, and...
Was bingo popular with you? I mean, did you like it?
Right, it was something to do, and if you were lucky enough to win, you know, you won a few ackers and that bought you another bottle of beer. So, not like you compare it today, you know, where you win vast sums.
So how long was this, how long were you at Beni Youssef and Mina, that area?
6 weeks, something like that. And then we were sent up again to take our part in the line, you see.
Was this facing, because by then Tobruk was properly besieged. So where were you?
Well, you
were part of the relieving group.
Yeah. And it was some months, I'm trying to think just where the line was at that time. That I would have to check on, but we were sort of in between Tobruk and the Delta, you know, where the line was, and until they launched the relieving operation to relieve Tobruk.
And that'd be about, I think, November, wasn't it?
About November, yeah.
Now, what was...
By the Christmas, I can remember the Christmas, we were at Marble Arch then.
Now, what do you remember of that period in the Western Desert, from about May or June, possibly, through to the offensive? I mean, what was the routine like in the desert?
Well, you left very much on your own. It was mainly, you might be doing, the carriers did a lot of scouting work, you know, to check out for enemy columns. But basically, on anti-tank guns, you were settled into a position.
What would an anti-tank gun position look like? How would you prepare a position in the desert?
Well, you dug a small pit about 3 foot deep, and nearby you dug two or three slit trenches, one for your brain gunner, and the others as an escape hatch if you were spotted and your gun got knocked out or you looked like getting overrun. But there were periods when, if it was fluid, rather than take the gun off, you'd leave it on the portee and be ready and notice to move to wherever you were wanted, and then you would then take it off the portee to go into action, because while you could fire them off the back of a portee, it wasn't very wise, because you were the size of a London bus, so you made a very big target, and I think the Guards Brigade made that mistake and lost most of their portees.
And anything you remember happening during that period? It was a period of routine, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, you were more or less left to yourself, and what you did was, you know, sort of maintenance on the gun. You cleaned it. You and the driver had his daily maintenance for his truck and such like, but it was merely filling in the time and waiting.
What about the type of food you got in the desert? What do you remember of that? So, you know, just what the rations?
A bit grim. You see, we never had a central cookhouse that brought meals up like the heavy infantry. You were issued for each section. I mean, our section would be, I'd say, 6-7 men. And what you do, when A echelon came up, you went down and they stuck so many rations for 6 men in a sandbag. It was all tin stuff, and you took it back. And you decided what you were going to have, whether you were going to have bully stew, fried bully, or... Because the bully beef, you see, when you undid it in heat, first of all, the fat ran out onto the plate, and then the bully beef come out with a squelch as it landed. You know, it wasn't like you get it out of the fridge. So it was just... Our driver, actually, was the main cook.
What would he do with it?
Well, as I say, made a bully... You got enough water, you made a bully stew, If you left it overnight, you might be able to harden it up and cut it, and you could fry it slices. And the other thing he used to do was get the hardtack biscuits. You always got a big tin of those. Plenty.
What were they like?
Yeah. Horrible. And
why? What was wrong with them?
Well, they were that hard. You couldn't break them. And, if you could soak them in your tea, you might be able to shuffle them up. And the standard thing, when you got the biscuits, you used to get... Sometimes you get little notes inside from the girls that packed them back in England, you see, and... We used to sometimes send notes back, if some of them put an address, we'd write back and say, thank you for the biscuits, but you forgot to include the hammer, because you couldn't break them up. But
what would they write to you? I mean, what would they put in the notes when they...
Well, best of luck, boys, if you're ever on leave, would you like my address and things like that, it's sort of a bit of a morale booster.
So you got bully beef and biscuits. What else?
Oh, you got meat and veg, tinned meat and veg.
Was that the McConaughey's or was it a different?
Well, it was similar to that. You see, a lot of the rations that we got, the majority came from either some came from England, but a lot came from India, and that was about the standard of the Indian subcontinent, and it was Indian. Sub-ration. But if you were lucky, every now and again you would get South African rations. Now, they were different, because you would get tins of peaches, and their M&V was far superior, but the South African standard, you hope for them, and the South African cigarettes, whereas we got the Indian Victory V's, which even hardened smokers used to throw away. You couldn't keep them alive.
What was so bad with them?
You couldn't. It tasted horrible. Well, I think in my book of things, I've got a pal of mine standing by the rear end of a donkey and saying, underneath I put a packet of V's and said, well, this is Bill collecting the cigarette ration from the manufacturer, you see. And that's what they tasted like. In fact, those people that smoked a pipe used to prefer to get camel scrub, which is like a dried white stuff, which camels enjoy. And they used to break it up and stuff it in their pipe. They prefer that to the Victory V's. But they were pretty grim. I don't know what they did. They were packed that tight. You lit them and you just couldn't draw them. And the tobacco was horrible.
What about any fresh food in the desert?
No. No, none at all.
What about water? Water rations and tea? I mean, can you talk about
Tea, yeah.
Talk about them both,
Well, water ration, while things were quiet, you weren't too bad. You got, forget how much it was a man, but you got an allowance of so much a man, and it was reasonable. But if the echelons were delayed in bringing up, or at times if you were in action, then you might be restricted to half a gallon, even less, per man, and you would get the order no washing and shaving, and you used it entirely for drinking, and you always kept your water bottle filled. That was, you weren't allowed to break into that or your emergency rations, which was a tin with a bar of horrible cocoa-tasting chocolate. Excuse me. They were inspected. The officer used to come round and check that you had not touched your emergency rations. You had to produce them. And you could tell whether they'd been opened, the way the tin was made. And used to check on you whether you got your water bottle full. But... tea, the system of making tea was that you had an open square can which you filled with water, put on your fire. Now, the system of fire, you got an empty 4-gallon petrol can, poke some holes in it, half filled it with sand, then poured in a gallon or a couple of gallons of petrol, and lit it. And it used to give the sand, being mixed in with the sand, it used to give a steady flame, and window, you stick your open billy can on the top. When it got to boiling, you sort of took your hand, used your hand, guessed how much tea was wanted, threw it in and let it brew up, and then sort of took it off. We also had a system of when...
Did you put a lot of sugar in as well?
No, well, sometimes you had sugar, sometimes you didn't. It didn't worry me, because I didn't take sugar in tea, so it didn't.
They didn't just put it in automatically then?
No, no.
Brewing it up, so you had your choice.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, we're carrying on to that. I interrupted you.
We had a system whereby, I mean, tea was such a, shall we say, a rarity, you know, you had possibly three brews a day, that we had a system. Initially, you drew lots, and then it worked on a rotor. That one person, when the tea was all used up, you had this mass of tea leaves left in the can, and the winner got those. And what you did was you picked them out and you chewed them to get the moisture out of them. And then, of course, when you were spitting all the tea leaves out of your mouth. So, nevertheless, it was a bonus to get when it was your turn for the tea leaves.
What about so you were living? What were your dugouts like? I mean, you know,
you just stopped in the open. You know, I mean, you dug slit trenches in case something happened, but you didn't sort of live in them. You were parked nearby, so that if planes came over, or you know, suddenly a couple of armored cars appeared out the thing and started popping away at you, you had somewhere to dive into. But you lived on the level of the desert, you know.
What about the sort of desert fauna, you know, little animals, insects? People are often fascinated by this. I mean, the desert rats, you know, the jiboa.
Yeah.
Was there much insect life, or scorpions, or jiboas, or anything
A reasonable number of scorpions came across.
Did they bother you?
Not particularly, no. I can remember one of our chaps getting bitten by one, and sort of immediately we had at that time we had a bottle of gin which we got from a dump, and he poured that on it to use as disinfectant. But the things that we came across more were the, I never know whether it's chameleon or chameleon. And if you saw one of those, we used to get it, tie a bit of string round its rear leg and then tie it onto something on the truck and leave it there. So that when we sat down, we used to sit near it, near the truck where the chameleon was tied. And then, of course, immediately, as soon as you got the food out, flies used to come down and the chameleon, you know, used to go blop, blop, gobble them up. And so you had one very happy chameleon, a very happy crew that managed to get their food without being besieged by flies, because the big trouble was that as soon as you knocked yourself, it turned into a desert sort.
Hang on, let's talk about the flies first. How much of a nuisance were the flies?
Oh God, they're horrible. You know, I mean, if you were drinking tea, you'd suddenly get about a dozen of them all around your mouth, trying to get inside because of the moisture. And, you know, you're sort of trying to do that and drink your tea at the same time. They were ever present. In fact, we had, it was a horrible thing to do, but they were saying everybody got desert sores, you know, because of lack of fresh vegetables or fresh food. So that when you knocked yourself, it immediately festered and it turned into a desert sore. And everybody used to walk around with a bit of bandage around their hands or neck or something. But we had one chap, he was very unfortunate. He was covered with these damn things. And consequently, the flies used to come down, if you had a bit of bandage on, was it? And they landed like a spike that used to penetrate through the bandage and into this damn sore. You know, it was a moisture they were after. So this chap, we used to get him and serve him his meal, and then we used to move away because He had more Desert Sword than anybody else. It was a pretty horrible thing to do, but he didn't mind. He got waited on. But, you know, when it got too bad, eventually the chap I'm talking about, when it got too bad, they eventually sent them back, evacuated them, and sort of pumped them full of whatever, vitamins, I suppose, whatever, to try and clear them up.
Did they give you them ascorbic acid tablets while you were out there, or no. Not that you knew? What about any other help? I mean, I don't mean later when you're in action more, but more in the quieter period, you know, while you're sort of in the desert, but waiting. Mm. Were there any health problems that came up other than the desert sores?
No, you know, sometimes somebody might get a jippy tummy, you know, get the runs or something like that, but we seem to remain reasonably healthy. It was surprising, you know, when the on the food we were getting. The other two things, incidentally, talking of food, was you got tinned cheese and...
You got what?
Tinned cheese and tinned bacon. It was Canadian. And what it was virtually 90% fat, and the rest was the little bit on the end. And it used to be rolled in greaseproof paper and then tinned. And that was pretty grim, but... Whether it was a fat that was good for you, I don't know, and the cheese, but it seemed to keep us reasonably healthy, you know. And I don't remember too many people going down with sickness or anything like that.